Psykiatrikerna.
Välkommen till det tredje avsnittet av vår podcast Deep Psychiatry's podd med mig Simon Kjaga.
Och med mig Anders Hansen.
Och idag har vi den stora förmånen att presentera ännu en möjlig Nobelprisvinnare.
Nämligen amerikanen Carl Diceroth vid Stanford-universitetet som är världens just nu förmodligen mest hyllade forskare, ska jag säga. Och han har inte bara utvecklat en utan två tekniker som båda nog håller Nobelprisklass faktiskt.
Och dessutom är han runt 40 år och arbetar kliniskt med terapirefraktära depressioner.
Så är det. Och den första tekniken han har utvecklat som har rönt den här uppmärksamheten, den kallas för Clarity-tekniken och bygger i korthet på att man gör hjärnan genomskinlig och tittar på enskilda neuron med form av ljusmikroskop. Vi ska inte gå in på den i detalj utan vi ska prata om hans andra teknik som man också har grundlagt och som kanske är ännu mer hyllad.
Och det är ju optogenetik. En otroligt fascinerande metod där man med hjälp av egentligen ljus olika färger kan deaktivera eller aktivera olika nervceller. Så från en kongressbyggnad, Mr. Optogenetics Carl Diceroth.
So that's it. It's pretty simple, but it took about 10 years to work out all the bugs. And now it's finally working pretty well.
And why is optogenetics so important?
Well, you know, it takes us beyond observation and correlation in neuroscience. And, you know, there's so much complexity in the brain, so much pioneering, wonderful work relating the activity patterns that are seen and the behaviors that are seen. But it's been a little less clear which cells, which cell types, which projections across the brain are causally involved in driving behaviors, whether adaptive or maladaptive.
So the main difference is that previously we were able to more look on correlations and associations.
That's right.
And now we have the opportunity actually to intervene.
Yes.
And also to do that temporally.
To do it. That's right. That's right. So of course there are many, you know, wonderful ways to intervene. In experimental systems or clinical systems, you can use genetic or pharmacological methods, but they don't give you the opportunity of playing in neural codes, neural dynamics, in the way that you would like. Now, electrodes are fast. Electrodes, you can work on the millisecond scale, but they have a problem too. They can't discriminate different kinds of cells. All neurons look more or less the same to an electrode, and even neurons that are side by side that may be doing something different or even oppositional would be driven equally by an electrode. So what optogenetics, the way we get around that is we use light-activated proteins that are themselves ion channels, and we use genetic tricks to introduce these only into the cell types or the connections across the brain that we are studying, and then we deliver light with fiber optics to the tissue, but only the cells and only the components that we've made light sensitive will respond, and depending on which protein we give them, one that lets positive ions into the cell or one that lets negative ions into the cell, we can turn on or off just the cells we want with millisecond precision.
It's very specific then.
It's very specific. Cell type and connection type, that's right. And the reason it can be so specific is these proteins are wonderful. And these come from biology. They are called the microbial opsins. And these are proteins that are made by algae, single-celled algae, and archaebacteria. And they are, of course, made by these organisms for other purposes. But what they do use is a vitamin A-like derivative called retinal. So these are retinal-binding proteins, not too dissimilar from what's in our eye, except what is different is that they are themselves also ion channels, whereas the photoreceptor proteins in our eyes are not. And this means that the retinal, which absorbs the photon, it has a conformational change. It opens the flow of ions across the membrane in a very fast, reliable way. And that's why it can be so efficient and precise and specific.
So basically what you do is that you use a vector, a virus, to introduce these ion channels that are sensitive to light.
That's right.
And once they are, and they have these, the vector is inserted, then basically you just turn on the light and you can decide whether to activate or deactivate a cell.
That's exactly right. That's
the trick is to get the right cells to express these proteins, of course.
Yes, so then the question is, how do you do your targeting then? Mm-hmm. So that's a early on, and this is one of the issues I was alluding to early on. You know, we got things working in a dish and then in an animal early on, but a lot of people said, well, okay, that's nice, but how are you going to, in a really versatile, generalizable way, make it possible for people to target the light sensitivity to just the cells you want? And it took us about 5 years to figure that out, and we have a couple ways of doing it that are very versatile now. One of them uses viruses that are broken. We've broken them particularly, so they don't work, but they only will start to work when you've also introduced them into an animal that makes the repair mechanism only in the cell type of interest. And this is a strategy called recombinase driver genetics. And it's widely used now. There are thousands of recombinase driver mouse lines, for example. We made recombinase driver rat lines. All this means is you can look through the brain of a mouse or a rat and find cells that have already been made. You can get these mouse lines or rat lines, and you can use one of these broken viruses and inject it into one of these mice or rats, and you won't get any expression except in the cells that you're interested in, because only those cells will be able to fix the virus and drive the opsin expression. That was one strategy. Another strategy uses no genetics at all. We can just use anatomy, and we call this projection targeting. And the way this works is the opsins fill the whole cell. They fill the cell body, and they also go down the axon. And what this means is you can bring in your light not to the spot where you delivered the virus, but to somewhere else across the brain.
Okay.
And by doing that, you'll recruit only the cells that send axons from where you injected the virus to where your light is. And so you're getting a specific long-range connection across the brain defined only by anatomy. That's and fantastic. That is very versatile and works extremely well.
I mean, this all seems amazing and sci-fi even, to consider that is possible. I mean, what would you say that the clinical implications, because I understand now that we are seeing some clinical implications with regards to, for instance, Parkinson?
Well, you know, the main value of optogenetics, I think, is purely as a research tool. Mm-hmm. And I think it's true, there are some people who are thinking about possible clinical applications. Mm-hmm. And I'm not doing that in my laboratory, but I think if that does work, that would be great. But even in that case, its significance for psychiatry even will be dwarfed by the research importance of it, because as you all know, as psychiatrists, we would very much love to understand how neural circuits work and how they fail to work at a deep level. And that would inform everything. That would help us design better medications. It would help us design better transcranial magnetic stimulation or deep brain stimulation protocols or positioning. All of these things would be better if we had better understanding. And so that I see as the main impact, even in animal models, to build an understanding of the causal underpinnings of adaptive or maladaptive behavior.
But I also wanted to ask, because when I first saw a film on optogenetics with a mouse and a flashlight on the head, where you could actually basically decide where the mouse should go, in a sense, first impression was, this is amazing. And then very shortly afterwards, this is really scary.
Yeah,
so, I mean,
yeah.
What is your take on that? Do you see any dangers in this method?
You know, it's an interesting question. You know, of course, everything we do as psychiatrists affects the brain, and we affect very deep, profound things about the brain and behavior all the time. So maybe it shouldn't scare us so much. But it is scary. I agree with you. in the sense that it's the precision that's a little scary, I think, because, you know, we can you know, use talk therapy and cognitive behavioral therapy, and we can help people. We can give medications or brain stimulation treatments, and we can help people or cause side effects. But none of them have the sort of precision that the sort of movies that you're talking about seem to convey. And so you could ask, well, if we could really control behavior or motivation that well, what are the implications? And I think we're a long way from it being an urgent concern, but it's a very interesting concern. I have to agree with you on that. And we've, in our animals, we can affect all manner of very interesting priorities and motivations, performance characteristics, and so on. So I think the ethicists and philosophers on the over the decade timescale will they'll have to be part of the discussion.
Will it be possible to do it non-invasive, do you think, in the future?
Well, we can already, even back in 2007, we were able to get it working through the skull of a mouse without broaching the skull itself. But it still required prior injection of the virus.
Of course, yes.
So in that sense, it always will be somewhat invasive and will require, you know, of course, you know, consenting, you know, willing participants and so on. But some of these options that we've made now are so light sensitive that indeed the light does not have to be delivered through a skin penetrating source.
And it also works for humans.
Well, in principle, you know.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Nobody has done that experiment.
Theoretically,
in human beings, but there's no obvious technical barrier to that.
So what would your suggestion be then to, you know, young aspiring psychiatrists or psychiatrists in general who find this fascinating, optogenetics and psychiatry in general? What would you recommend people to
yeah.
do?
I think it would be good to, you know, to read a couple of the reviews on the field. I wrote one in 2014 that was really focused for understanding maladaptive behavioral experiments, and so that's maybe worth looking at. If you search maladaptive behavior and my name and optogenetics, you'll find it. But it's I think staying up with the literature on optogenetics is going to be useful in the long run, because I think ideas coming from that domain will start to affect right. how we do psychiatry.
And what drives you in this? What makes it? Why do you do this?
Well, a lot of it comes from my clinical background. You know, I very much want to understand the brain, in part to make better headway on these disorders. But also I'm very curious about the brain. Honestly, I started as a basic scientist, and I just have an intense curiosity as any little child poking something with a stick, and I just want to figure it out.
Det är en otroligt intressant teknik, optogenetik. Det slår en verkligen när man hör det här, tycker jag.
Ja, Carl Liseroth har ju verkligen grundlagt den här metoden.
Så är det, och han betonar ju här att det är något som kan användas och som kommer att användas för grundforskning för att öka förståelsen om hjärnan generellt. Men precis som du tog upp i intervjun här, Simon, så får man ju lite kalla kårar när man förstår på vilket sätt det här skulle potentiellt kunna missbrukas.
Ja, det är ju svårt att inte tänka det när man ser de här bilderna på mössen som man helt enkelt kan styra i labyrinter beroende på vilken färg på ljuset man introducerar. Samtidigt så tycker jag en väldigt positiv sak med Liseroths forskning är att han betonar ju vikten av grundforskning. Att inte från början veta exakt vad forskningen ska leda fram till. Hela den här forskningen som ligger till grund för egentligen optogenetik har ju gjorts av biologer som har studerat encelliga varelser och bakterier.
Verkligen, och att det finns ett värde av att förutsättningslöst leta efter kunskap, och sen så, för man kan inte i förväg säga vilken nytta man ska få av allt, utan naturvetenskaplig och medicinsk forskning måste utgå från att man förutsättningslöst lite söker efter ny information. Men jag tycker ibland när man ser en presentation eller föreläsning så känner man verkligen att det här är ett steg framåt. Det här tar saker ett steg vidare till en helt annan nivå. Och det, den upplevelsen får man verkligen när man ser honom presentera både Clarity men framförallt optogenetik, tycker jag.
Ja, Clarity har vi inte pratat om i den här podden, men det är ju i och för sig ämne för en helt egen podcast faktiskt. Men när vi pratar om optogenetiken, då får jag samma känsla som jag misstänker att man fick i princip första gången man såg en röntgenbild. Alltså det är möjligheten att faktiskt se vad som händer i hjärnan live. Och inte nog med att bara kunna se det, utan att faktiskt påverka det som händer i den levande hjärnan.
Precis, och dessutom att kunna se det i detalj på nivån enskilda neuron, enskilda hjärnceller alltså. Det är otroligt fascinerande.
Jag tänkte, du ställer den här ganska intressanta frågan. Kan den här metoden användas på människor? Han är ju lite sådär politisk i sitt svar där han säger att det här har ju inte använts på människor, men att det i teorin faktiskt skulle kunna användas på människor.
Ja, och jag tycker det är extremt fascinerande och skrämmande att de här receptorerna känns som alltså känsliggör hjärncellerna för ljus. De är så pass känsliga att man skulle kunna lysa på huvudet, och det ljuset tränger alltså genom skallbenet in i hjärnan, så att det behöver inte vara en invasiv teknik längre.
Alltså för mig måste jag säga att mötet med Carl Diceroth, det var verkligen mötet med en person som på många sätt förkroppsligar den ideala psykiatriken. Oerhört sympatisk, briljant, men också med ett väldigt brett intresse för många saker. Inte bara psykiatri och forskning, utan även andra aspekter av samhället.
Mm, precis. Och därmed så tackar jag, som heter Anders Hansen,
och Simon Kaga,
för att ni har lyssnat på det här poddavsnittet.
Den här podcasten har möjliggjorts genom Otsuka och Lundbeck. People creating products for better health worldwide with progress in mind.